Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. It is 9:07 on Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Alaska's capital, Juneau, Alaska, in the state capitol, room 532. With me at the table this morning, welcome Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Good morning.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy. And we should be joined shortly by Co-Chairman Kelly, who's been on other statement business in committee earlier this morning. Before the committee today is a presentation from the Department of Administration on contracts that Co-Chairman Kelly requested on the committee's behalf. Commissioner Fischner, if you could introduce yourself and those at the table with you, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're pleased to be here. My name is Sheldon Fischer. I'm the commissioner from the Department of Administration, and with me is Leslie Rydell, who is one of our deputy commissioners. Moving to slide two, just to give a little background on the bargaining process, we have 11 collective bargaining agreements. By statute, those agreements tend to be a three-year term. They cannot exceed a three-year term, and so we rotate roughly a third each year that we renegotiate, and I'll give a little detail on that a little bit later. We typically begin the negotiation process in the fall between October and December. Those dates are defined in each respective collective bargaining agreement, but the parties can start earlier if they determine that that's appropriate and agree. We have certain mandatory subjects of bargaining that include wage hours and other terms and conditions of employment. Some of those other terms might include schedule, work rules, required uniforms, things of that nature. There are other areas that it's permissive to bargain, but we're not required to, and those might include the classifications, retiree benefits, representation of non-permanent employees, and things like that. When we're done with the bargaining process and once we've reached tentative agreement with each respective bargaining unit, we will submit those terms to the legislature for your approval. By statute, provided that we submit those terms by the 60th day, then PARA requires that the legislature consider those terms during that session. If we submit after the 60th day, the legislature is not required by PARA, but often will consider those monetary terms nevertheless. If the legislature accepts the monetary terms and approves them, then the contract, provided it is also ratified by the union, the contract goes into effect. If rejected, then it's as if there was no agreement and the parties, in essence, recommence the negotiation. And later in this presentation, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. If the parties do not lead to an agreement and mediation fails, then the state has the right to implement their last and final offer. And the employees the bargaining unit have the right to strike. Now, the one exception to that are what we might call Class 1 employees or protective service personnel, and that includes police and fire and the jails and prisons and people, functions like that. They do not have the right to strike. But they have the right to go to binding arbitration and resolve any disputes through the arbitration process. Employees that are on strike do not get paid, provided that it's a lawful strike, they may not be terminated. Striking employees may be replaced, and it's conceptually they may be replaced temporarily or under certain conditions permanently. Generally, they're replaced on a temporary basis. Moving to slide three, just to give you a sense of what constitutes monetary terms, as you can appreciate it, it would include wages and leave provisions and items of that nature, but it essentially covers anything that would require money to fund. And so as you see on this page in the various bargaining units, training funds, education, medical exams, differentials in pay, uniform allowances, things of that nature that require some funding to in order to achieve. Those would consist of monetary terms, and those would be the terms that we would submit to the legislature for your approval. Moving to slide four, I wanted to give a little bit of a sense of how the range of options, if you will, for reaching resolution with a bargaining unit. On the far right-hand side is a negotiated settlement, and that is what we strive to do, is to reach an agreement that both parties find in their best interest. In the event that we are not able to reach a negotiated settlement, then the parties can choose to go to arbitration. For the Class 1 employees, these are the police and fire and prison employees, there is a right to demand arbitration. But for the other classes, it is something we would have to agree upon with the bargaining unit. When you think about arbitration, there's a number of different alternatives, but two that I just thought I would throw out there are the typical, what we might refer to as interest arbitration, where the arbitrator can decide on a provision-by-provision basis how to resolve the dispute. Or the alternative to that is what we refer to as baseball arbitration, where both parties submit their best and final offer to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator is required to select one or the other in totality. As you might appreciate, baseball arbitration kind of helps force the parties closer together because neither party wants to be the one that has a proposal that is deemed to be extreme or out of place in the marketplace, and because it's likely to be the one that is rejected by the arbitrator. On the other hand, interest arbitration tends to keep the parties further apart because people will leave things in their proposal that they are willing to lose, hoping that the arbitrator will take some of those less important provisions and give those to the other party and maintain the provisions that are the most important to each party. So, again, in summary, baseball tends to force parties closer together. Classical interest arbitration tends to keep the parties positioned further apart. The final alternative is that if the parties are unable to agree and refuse to go to arbitration, there is the ability to negotiate to impasse. And impasse means that both parties have submitted their best and final proposal, and there's not agreement, and there's not a willingness to continue considering alternatives. And then in that scenario, the employer does have the right to implement their last and final offer, and on the other side, the bargaining unit has the right to strike at that point, subject to some of the limitations we've already spoken about. This is sometimes referred to as the nuclear option because it is very damaging to the relationship. It means that the two parties really are not able to work together and are even unwilling to kind of move to arbitration, and so it tends to be harmful to a employer-labor relationship. Moving to slide five, this is a summary of our bargaining units, the number of employees, and kind of the schedule in which we are negotiating. At the current time, as you see there, we are negotiating with five of our bargaining units, LTC or Local 71. Actually, we have been negotiating for over a year now. We were negotiating the last session with them as well and didn't come to agreement, which meant that the terms just continued. As you can see there, when you include those five bargaining units plus the non-covered employees that tend to follow the terms of the bargained agreements, 87% of our employees are impacted by this current round of negotiations or bargaining. And so that's obviously an important number. It's impactful to the state, and emphasizes the importance of these bargaining, of this bargaining session.
Commissioner, could you pause just for a moment? Senator Machicki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, when were the costs associated with the 2015-16 negotiations hit the state budget?
So through the chair, if I understand the question, these five bargaining units will be for the fiscal year 17 budget that this will be impacting. And so any costs or savings that we're just going to discuss will not be in the current fiscal year, but the next fiscal year.
Senator Machicki?
And would your expectations, which is probably tough for you to determine at this point, would your expectation be that most of the five were completed by the end of this fiscal year?
So I'll talk about that. I've got a slide specifically on that. I think that the short answer is that we presented two of the five to you. There's two more, LTC and confidential employees, that we believe will be completed by the 60th day. The APEA or the supervisors union, those discussions are a little bit more challenged, and so I'm not confident that we'll be done by the 60th day. I'm an optimist. I'm optimistic that we'll be done by the end of the session, but that's one that is taking us a little longer.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, was it which unit has not closed their contract negotiations? It's been open for over a year.
Through the chair, that's LTC or Labor Trades and Crafts, Local 71. But we are making progress with them, and I am optimistic that we'll have something by the 60th day of the session.
Senator Machicki?
I'm not sure if that's the question that the co-chair had, but is there a Marine Highway System union that completed negotiations last year and it hasn't been yet ratified by the members?
Through the chair, forgive me, yes. So MEBA, the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, we reached negotiation actually in the summer of 14, presented that to you for approval last session, and the legislature did approve it, and they have not submitted that to their members for ratification. And we're in mediation. We do seem stuck, candidly, and so that is ongoing. In the meantime, status quo continues, which in some respects is more favorable for the state. In other words, the status quo is less costly to the state than what we've bargained, and so candidly, we're a little puzzled why they have continued to resist.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you. Commissioner, is there a COLA in that group?
There is. The COLA that, forgive me, through the chair, the COLA that we negotiated was in the first year zero, and then one and two, but again, the first year's passed. We're now into what would have been the second year of that contract, where we had agreed to give them 1% COLA, and because they haven't ratified it, we're not paying them that COLA effectively.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we had a bill in front of us to remove or reduce COLA. Is that anything to do with those terms in that contract? We have a state statute that has some COLA in it.
Senator Chair, I think it was a geographic differential. It was.
Thank you very much. It was the geographic differential. Does that group benefit from the geographic differential?
They have a hold provision, so they do. Well, am I accurate in saying they have a hold? And yeah, and so it depends a little bit on how we have a few different terms. We've got sometimes we call it.
Commissioner, you said something that is, I think, relevant to the discussion, and your voice was pointed away from the microphone. Could you do that again?
Mr. Chair, I'll be. Thank you.
Yes.
NEPA does have a cold provision and a geographic differential. There are other terms that are sometimes used, sometimes subsistence pay and other things to deal with geographic cost differential, but NEPA does have a cold provision. I apologize, I'm not exactly familiar with the legislature you're referring to and whether it would impact that group or not.
Thank you, Mr.
We cleared that up. It was a geodiff.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Senator Machicki? Oh, excuse me. Senator Dunleavy and then Senator Machicki.
Just very, very brief. So this particular outfit that you're bargaining with has not gotten 1%, was that what I heard, a 1% COLA. But often, whether it drags on for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, often the final settlement retroactively pays that COLA. Is that part of the plan?
Through the chair, it's not part of my plan. I mean, our position has been with the bargaining unit that if they want those COLAs, they need to ratify it on a schedule.
Commissioner, what is the time frame on ratification? Is there a statutory limit? You may have covered that when I was gone, but
For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. There's no time frame for ratification, either in statute or in the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Fisher, as you said, it's not your plan to pay that. Are there provisions in the contract or in statute that would protect the state if this just runs out? We're not going to be in danger by statute or by the contract of paying a lump sum retroactive payment to get caught up, are we? Do you know? Ms. Sheehan, you have a little bit of a confused look in your face. Let me restate the question. So if we don't get that ratified at some time certain, is there a statute or is there something in the contract that will require us to make a retroactive payment to get caught up to speed, or is that purely a negotiation or a judgment call by the Commissioner's office?
Mr. Chair, there is nothing that requires a retroactive payment. That would be an agreement between the state and the union.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy?
It's just a follow-up. I know Senator Machicki's in line, but you basically exist in the existing contract, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
That's all you do, so there's no retroactivity on that unless you agree to it.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Last question. The concept of imposition of terms and conditions, is that familiar?
Through the chair, in other words, negotiating the impasse and implementing the best and final is, I think,
yes.
What you're referring to. Yes.
Okay.
Senator Dunleavy, I didn't hear that question.
Yeah, sorry. There's a concept called terms and conditions, imposition of terms and conditions. You'll sometimes hear that in negotiating. When you reach an impasse, you can't go any further than the administration imposes the terms and conditions. I just was wondering if that's a tool or is that part of potentially the process. It's not excluded from your process, correct?
Through the chair, no, it's
okay,
not.
Thanks.
Available.
Okay.
Mr. Commissioner, I would encourage you not to give up the retroactive payment that you push on them to ratify that contract because the legislature will certainly not. I don't mean to speak for everyone, but let me speak for everyone. We would look very unfavorably at that if all of a sudden we were stuck with a retroactive payment because they didn't follow through on some fairly common business practice and courtesy. Senator Machicki and then Senator McKinnon.
Commissioner, I was just wondering if you're sensing a willingness to, by the units, that we're in a very tough spot currently, if you're seeing some flexibility on realizing that we want to preserve as many jobs as possible, but still have this little sort of $4 billion fiscal gap. Are you sensing in your negotiations with the 5 units that are currently active that they recognize our situation and might be more open to more flexibility than you've seen in the past?
Commissioner?
The Chair, yes, I think that's true. And, of course, each bargaining unit is a little bit different, and we'll talk about it as we go into some of the details and give you an update on kind of where we're at. Certainly the two bargaining units that we've already submitted the terms and we'll give you the details on today, which are GGU, our largest bargaining unit and team, I think they really did come to the table with an appreciation and a recognition that they needed to make concessions. They needed to be part of the solution. Neither we nor they felt like the employees alone could solve the budget, the fiscal crisis, but I think that there was a recognition. And I really do appreciate the professionalism and the openness with which they came to the bargaining table. And I hope you'll agree with us when you see some of the terms.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in your backup documents, I looked at the Marine Engineers and Beneficial Association, MEBA, and did just an average, a very high-level look at overtime versus the members in the bargaining unit. So MEBA has 103 bargaining unit members with an overtime cost exceeding $1 million. And so if I just did the math correctly, that's an average of about $9,800 of overtime paid for each of these individuals, which gets me to my question. How is it that someone can reside in a different port than they get paid for from a home port? How does that work in the contract?
I'll let...
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon. So I understand the question. How is it that you get paid for to go to a different port than you are assigned to, than your home port?
If you can answer that and then tell me why we have such high overtime for this particular group. 103 people are getting an awful lot of overtime.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I'm not able to address the overtime question. That is a question for Alaska Marine Highways, which I can certainly follow up with them on that. There are different provisions for when you are assigned to different vessels. You have your home port and your home vessel, but depending on scheduling, which is done, I believe, quarterly, you may be assigned to a vessel outside of your home port. But I can follow up with Marine Highways on those questions.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you. I'd appreciate the follow-up. Is it true that that when they're on the ships, they're on four-hour cycles?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I do not believe they are on four cycles. They are marine engineers in the Southwest system. On some vessels, work 8.4 hours. On the Southeast system, they work 12-hour days, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
I'd like some explanation on $10,000 worth of overtime per individual. And that's annually, so that's over a large period of time. But just to understand why we can't manage that overtime a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Go ahead.
So moving to slide, well, let me, if I didn't, maybe I've already said this, but on slide five, we historically have treated the non-covered employees essentially identical to the supervisors union. And I think that depending on where we end up with negotiations, I just want to let you know that we are contemplating whether we would treat them differently in some areas where we have the discretion, particularly furloughs and a health care contribution. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And moving to slide six, I wanted to kind of frame the way I have thought about and the way we've thought about the framework. And the next two slides will talk about cash compensation and benefit associated with employment. On the cash compensation side, you see here that in addition to COLAs, people do receive merit increases and pay increments. And every through year one through five of a person's employment, they get approximately a 3.5% increase, and thereafter, and that's every year, forgive me, and thereafter, every other year, they get about a 3.25% increase. And and I've said this before, I think here, that's a fairly steep curve. But as we have looked at this overall cash compensation package, it's my belief that, in fact, state employees probably on the cash side are a little bit below market. Now, that's going to be, when we get to benefits, the benefits are probably above market. And it doesn't necessarily split equally. So high-income professional employees tend to be below market, and we tend to struggle to recruit and hire those professional employees. And then new employees that are kind of at the beginning of this curve that you see illustrated below tend to be below market. On the other extreme, low-income employees oftentimes tend to be at or above market pay. And then more tenured employees, as you start to get out 15 and 20 years into your cycle, you tend to grow, your compensation tends to grow above market. And so this was one, I guess overall the message is that when we looked at the cash compensation portion of our employee base, we felt like we needed to maintain no COLA increases, of course, some modest reductions, and you'll see those in the terms of furloughs, but we didn't feel like there was a dramatic need to readjust the cash compensation to market. We felt like, in fact, we were probably a little bit below market. Moving to
Commissioner, just could you pause for just a second? Senator Machicki and then Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm used to seeing a full burden comparison as opposed to cash compensation. Can we get this slide with the full package? It would be a lot more informative to me.
Through the chair, yes. We'll come back to you with a burden cost as well. Thank you.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. Should I extrapolate out, Commissioner, that in 2014 the combined COLA and merit increases in a 10-year cycle is somewhere around 62%, 63%?
I think that's fair. In other words, if you look at an employee from 10 years ending in 2014, the growth was on a combined basis a little over 60%.
And then, Commissioner, if I could follow up, who are you classifying as part of our labor force that is low income? It doesn't say lower, it says low income. So how are you using the word in this slide? And how is that somebody that's making below $100,000? Is it somebody below $75,000? How should I interpret low-income employees?
Through the chair, lower would probably be a better term, but I'm thinking about these as people that tend to be class 15 and below, which I think their compensation would probably be between 40 and cash compensation, you know, maybe $40,000, $45,000 and less would be the lower income employees.
Thank you. I just was trying to quantify the level.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It'd be interesting if you could pull together for me a slide that shows by bargaining unit the number of employees by range. You don't need it today, obviously, but if the committee would like that, Mr. Chairman, we could bring it back for the full committee.
Mr. Chairman, deeper in the deck, we do have an average pay scenario, but I'd certainly be interested in Senator Bishop's request for the ranges so that we can see how each unit is populated and what salaries folks are climbing to or moving through in that.
The chair will be happy to pull that together.
Thank you.
Where it is. We're back on the record. Commissioner, I'm going to ask a question on merit system. Have you explored the possibility of switching over the merit system to every 2 years for new employees? The first take that we have on it, some research that one of the offices did, was that it could save us $19 million. Was it in 2 years? In 2 years, yeah. Do you have any evidence of that? And what are the pitfalls of that? Does that mess up negotiations, or what's the deal on that? If you could just kind of talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, so we did look at that, and I'm going by memory now, but I think your figures on a two-year basis is roughly in line with the analysis we did, and we can come back with that specific result. I guess a couple of things. What you'll see in the subsequent slides is a view that, given that our belief that overall cash compensation seems to be below market and that benefits seem to be above market, we focused our negotiations at this time on trying to bring the benefits kind of in line, and particularly healthcare benefits, which are growing so rapidly. So we elected not to make that a focus of the negotiations.
Can I interject just one thing, and that is though for new employees, we could institute that as a statute change, and it wouldn't affect your negotiations. Is that correct? Is that a correct assumption?
I don't think that's correct. I'll ask Kate to validate, but I believe that we would have to negotiate that change in our bargaining unit as well.
Kate?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we would need to negotiate that for the classified employees.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy, and then Senator Bishop.
Thank you, through the Chair. A question I was asking during the break, if we can put on the record. The spread between the lines in the graph, especially between the green line, 21.4%, and the red line of 44%. And a secondary question, why is it a 44% when the line appears to go above the 60 percentile?
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question.
I'm sorry.
We're going to have to come back and confirm these numbers. In essence, stating the obvious, the blue line represents the COLA, the green line represents the merit and steps. No, I'm sorry.
No.
Forgive me.
CPI.
Oh, the green line represents, yeah. If you don't mind, let us come back and...
That's fine, Commissioner. If you want some time to think about that, that's fine.
Just for the record, so the question would be, what is the actual percent, not the number, is it 44 or 60-some? And then what is your, to the best of your knowledge, what do you believe is causing that spread, or if that spread really exists? I mean, after you check your facts and your figures...
When you say the spread.
So in 04, the lines almost seem to intersect, and then after that, they diverge, they don't converge.
Well, forgive me. So that's easy to answer. In 04, the assumption is that that's a brand new employee in 2004. So this is the life cycle of an employee for 10 years starting in 2004. And so by definition, everything starts at the zero point in 04. And then you've got the COLA increases that were negotiated, those are actual COLA increases that were negotiated over those years, and then you've got the merit and the pay increments added on to that, and that's how it diverges.
To the Chair, one more follow-up.
Go right ahead.
So thank you for that clarification. And then, again, when you look at the green line, CPI 21.4%, and then the red line at 44%, which really looks like it's above 60, but you'll take a look at that. Why is there such a spread there?
So the COLA increases are roughly comparable to the CPI, a little bit less. I mean, as you can see there, our COLAs have been slightly below the CPI. It's the merit and the pay increments that drive that additional growth. And there again, it kind of gets back to the salary schedule that the state has created. It's my perception that when an employee starts working at the state, they tend to be below market. They tend to be paid less than market rates. And over the life of that employee, they will tend, and it's going to vary depending on the function. Some of them may never get to market, particularly some of our more professional, more skilled people. Many of them could do better outside of the state. But their pay will increase and grow over time, and some of them will get above market by the end of their career. And so it is a system, and I guess that, you know, the question would be, if we were to design this system today, would we design it this way? I personally wouldn't. I think that it makes it difficult to recruit. It makes it difficult to recruit the best, most talented people out there in those early years. You have to find people who are kind of willing to take a long-term view and recognize that there's a different benefit package, and there's going to be growth in salaries. And so, but it is the system we've got. And as I say, overall, it's my view that our overall compensation package, cash compensation component of the package, is probably actually tends to be below market.
It's just a follow up, just a clarification on this issue. You said it's a salary schedule issue the state created. You're not talking about the negotiations process. You're talking about some other framework, correct?
Well, forgive me, through the chair, it's a little bit of both. In other words,
the state, you negotiate, so you create that framework with each negotiations. I mean, there's a broad framework that by law, and we know that, but you said this. I'm just trying to find out. There were two things that seemed to merge as one, and now I'm confused. State by statute, state via administration by negotiations. Can you differentiate those for me?
Thank you. Through the chair, it's not by statute.
Okay.
It is either through negotiation or even, as I understand, during the Palin administration, when there was a perception that we were struggling to be able to recruit and retain the employees we wanted, then we unilaterally gave some additional increases in unbargained. But now that we've given them, any changes to this would have to be bargained.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we talked about cash below market and benefits above market. Could you tell me what the benefits are and which one of the benefits is the biggest driver?
Through the chair, if we can, that perfect segue, thank you. Slide seven.
Before you segue off that, I kind of want to, if we could come back to Senator Bishop's question, I want to stop looking at the Legos for a minute and look at the picture on the box. When you talk about your overall philosophy, you have a job to do, and I respect it, and I think you do a pretty good job at it. It's always kind of disturbed me when I hear people in the state government and the university and like that talking about this need to recruit the best people. That's doing your job, so I don't criticize you for that. But there's a private sector out there that is in pretty serious competition with you guys, and it's hard for them to keep up. And that's what I say, let's look at the picture on the box. You're talking about long-term benefits, about recruiting the best people, making sure everybody's at market rates. I don't see people running away from state government to the private sector. I see them running from the private sector to state government. And I talk to people I know that own businesses, and they say they have a really hard time hanging on to people because they're viewed. They come to the job interview, they dress up and everything like that, and they get the job, but really they're thinking temporary. What I'm doing now is just fine, but what I really want is a state job. So I'd just like to kind of incorporate that in your thinking. I just don't think we think right about this, and I would prefer that the absolute best engineer is the one that's working for the company that's building the bridge, rather than the one that's making the regulations. So just kind of put that in your box as you're going forward. Senator Bishop.
My follow-up question, so you got my first question, and you've got to segue to the next page, maybe talk about it. The second question is, briefly, if you could tell us, if you can, that's fine. If you can't, that's fine too right now. How are you doing on retention and recruitment for state employees?
So, through the chair, with respect to retention and recruitment, and this goes directly to the point, Mr. Chair, that you're making, you know, I guess for our, what I would call our Tier 4 employees, those that are outside of the defined benefits plan, I don't have numbers to give you, but we'll come back with those. But my sense is that our retention is probably below average for an employer. We tend to have a lot of turnover early in the life cycle of an employee, which, again, is not necessarily unusual and supports our hypothesis that we start below market. I think in terms of recruitment, particularly for the higher skilled positions, I think we struggle to find qualified people.
One of the things I noticed when I was working at the university is that we tended not to lose people at the university to the private sector. We tended to lose them to other agencies. The feds were paying a little higher, and actually at the time, I'm not sure that's correct now, but the state was paying higher as well. Who's next? Senator Machicki.
So still on this slide, and one of the things I respect about you, Commissioner, is that you're private sector guy, and I appreciate that experience in a state agency. But again, we're on cash compensation. Just a couple numbers. If you got hired at $50,000 in 2004 and you were just received a COLA, you'd be making $59,500 today. If you received Anchorage CPI for increases only, you'd be making $60,500. Then the combination of actual pay here, cash only, cash compensation only, with 44% increase is $72,000 today. But without an all-in, including the benefit burden, it's really difficult to tell what the increases have been. The question I'm going to get to, and Mr. Chairman, I think it varies. Certain departments that we have, we really struggle to retain employees. Like Department of Transportation and Equipment Operator is far better compensated outside of the state system, and certain departments were a much better deal for them. But I think you have enough Department of Labor statistics for you to evaluate the average private sector increase from 2004 to 2014, which I think would be really helpful for us. I'd hate for us to have a picture of an increase that seems higher than market when, if you compare it to a private sector, cash compensation plus benefit burden might be comparable or higher. Is that something you think that you could provide working with the commissioner from the other department?
Through the chair, I will come back with specifics, but I agree with your premise, I think, which is that the growth that is represented on this page is higher than traditional in the marketplace. I think it's unusual to see this kind of growth over a 10-year period in the private sector. But that has to be tempered a little bit with a view that we start below marketplace. And so if and it's going to vary by job where the market is on this scale, but if it takes your first 4 to 5 years to kind of get to market or in some of those positions, and for example, in some of our positions, some of our trade positions, it does take actually 4 to 5 years just to get to where the apprentices are being paid outside of the state government. Then it puts that curve in, I think, a little bit different light, because you're recognizing that people are coming in below, they're building up, and then, okay, maybe they start to exceed, but it's the overall curve, the overall compensation scheme that you kind of have to think about.
Follow up,
Senator Machicki.
If you're somewhat pure on an apples to apples comparison, you're going to see the same under market for entry level in the private sector, and the same sort of increase as you prove up in your career. I mean, I think you can give us a picture that would help us understand how far we are outside of the norm.
Mr. Chair, let us try. Let us pull some information together and come back and give you and we'll maybe work together to see if we can answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, just last statement. I just think it would be helpful in giving the public sort of a more realistic view, wherever it may fall. I don't believe our public employees are dramatically overcompensated, and I think that would be something helpful for them to understand. It's just one of those urban legends that would be nice if you would put a little bit of research into that so we can understand the facts as opposed to how we think things look by looking at a chart like this.
I was just going to say that, you know, the urban legend, I believe you're correct, Senator Michiki, particularly at the lower level versus at the higher levels. When I was here years ago, we did a study on that, and the unfortunate results were that the people at the lower end of the scale were overcompensated and the people at the higher end of the scale were undercompensated. That isn't what people wanted to believe, but that's just kind of the way it was. But regarding state employment, we can't discount the motivation of an employee that they are entering a more secure environment with the state than they are with an oil company. I think of what I've heard of the upper executives at BP right now. They would love to have the support that we have and that most of the state managers have, but they've gone through huge cutbacks. And it's pretty volatile. They've lost a lot of people. It tends not to happen in state and municipal governments. So I think that's the kind of the unknown thing here when we're just talking about compensation is there's a value placed on long-term employment, on security, on benefits, and those kinds of things. And it's hard to quantify. Go ahead. Oh, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Sheldon, while that this class request that you have, I'd like to throw one more in there if it can be completed and not slow up the process. To me, but it would be interesting to see over this 10-year period, at the end of this 10-year period, how many of those employees have left state service for something else.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Fisher, Senator Michiki asked for that fully loaded look. And I wonder, as we look at the benefit side of the house, if we make sure to include all state contributions. And the reason I'm saying that, I'm thinking of SBS and the viability of Social Security for folks out, and it goes to the chairman's point about security and long-term benefit. But if we looked beyond the 10-year cycle even, right now we're suffering at a state level with an unfunded pension liability. And so a 10-year look at this is helping us to understand whether our employees are undervalued coming into the system and how much it costs us to carry forward and how quickly they catch up with a with their peers, whether it's the private sector or federal government or wherever that is. And again, Mr. Chairman, you pointed to one of the questions that I was going to raise, and that is the federal government is sometimes taking our state employees more often than the private sector, as I understand it, in specific areas, specifically geology or in our natural resources section. The federal government is taking trained and qualified employees and moving them into higher paid positions, and so we're sort of competing against ourselves in the federal government to state government. But I'm wondering if we looked at a 20-year cycle of an employee instead of a 10, what that picture would look like. If we looked at our court system, is that a 15-year retirement system for court system and a CPI that's tied to any contract negotiated is going actually into retirement costs also? I mean, there are some fixed numbers that are embedded in here that have some long-term implications that drive costs to us in a different way that the chairman is now struggling with in making those year-to-year payments to try to add more money back in to some of these things that are happening to us. And so does the picture look different if we look at a full retirement on some of these contracts that we're negotiating? And that's not specific to the marine issue or the labor issue or any of those, but are we looking at that from a high enough level to really understand the cost that the state is incurring in keeping all of our retirees secure in the benefits that we've promised them? It comes to mind to me and I've spoken to the chairman in DOT already, that we have some facilities where people go to acquire overtime to drive their high three up. And that's really hurting the system overall. I understand that employee is looking out for their family and trying to use the tools that are available to them to acquire those benefits. But in the end, as more and more people are doing that, we have this unfunded pension liability that continues to grow. And so when you bring that back fully loaded, I'd like to see it from start of employment till our obligation into retirement and whether we're collecting or balancing that out throughout. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, it's not specific to it's specific to all negotiations versus just what's in front of us from the administration. We've got judiciary, we've got corrections that are out there that are, have some high numbers that are getting in there, and we just have a huge obligation that people are expecting us to be able to step up and pay for, and we need everybody talking about the problems that are contributing to some of that unfunded liability.
Commissioner, we are at 10 o'clock now, and we have time, but let's move on if we could.
Thank you.
And if the members could maybe bunch up their questions or whatever.
That's what we did for the first six.
So moving to slide 7, touching on the benefits in particular, it is, as I've alluded to, our impression that the overall employee benefit package is above market compared to comparable packages in the private sector. And I agree that stability and security and a certain amount of flexibility is part of the package that's very difficult to quantify. But those things that we can quantify, in particular our health care benefits, is at the top of our list, first because they're expensive and it's growing faster than any other segment of the economy in terms of the cost. And so even when the normal CPI is flat or very low, you see 5 to 7 to 9% growth in healthcare, and that's putting a stress on the state and on our administration. In particular, you see a number of dimensions of our healthcare benefit that seems to be generous compared to the market. Nearly half of our employees are in the economy plan, which has no contribution. We tend to have a lower deductible than what is offered in the private sector. Retiree health insurance will vest after 10 years, and these things are drive health care costs for the state. Just to kind of round out some of the other benefits, the pension, obviously tiers 1 through 3, a defined contribution, that is unusual in the private sector. But even tier 4, which we've kind of described here, I think is quite effective from an employee's perspective in terms of the benefit they receive. And so as you see under PERS, there's an 8% employee at 5% employer plus the SBS, and I do understand that SBS is kind of a replacement for Social Security, and that's an appropriate, but I think the point that Senator McKinnon was making that, you know, when you look at that as a whole, 25% of an employee's compensation is available for them to invest and to manage, and that is I think that's a good thing, but it's a large number compared to the private sector. And an employee can, I think, if they are prudent and careful in terms of the management of those assets, can build up a retirement foundation that will sustain them well. And I think that most private employers where there's a modest match don't really have that opportunity. In addition, I know that it's been discussed before, and accrual leave, we're quite generous compared to the private sector, both in the rate at which the leave accrues as well as the caps. We've talked a little bit about flexibility, shorter work week. And so overall, I think our sense is that that our benefits package is above market. And so Our strategy in this negotiating session was to focus primarily on health care, and we identified kind of five priorities that we wanted to go after in our negotiation. And, of course, different bargaining units, health care is provided in different ways for the employees. And so for certain bargaining units, they're actually members of Alaska Care, and the state provides the health care. In other bargaining units, they are a member of a health care trust, and the state makes a contribution towards those trusts. And depending on the experience of the employees and the demographics of the employees, that has the opportunity to lead to potentially overfunding of some of those health plans. And so the five principles that we established for our negotiation was, first, that all employees must contribute something towards their health care premium. We think it's important both as a cost-saving measure, but more importantly, actually, it helps align the interest of the employee and the interest of the employer or the state in terms of managing health care costs. And there are tools and levers that are available in terms of management of health care costs, and so having the employees contributing towards that premium helps our interests be aligned. We also are asking that all health plans have at least two tiers, where they're of dependent coverage and employee only and employee plus family. We're asking that the health rate that is contributed to these other health plans reflect the true projected cost of the plan based on the demographics, the election, and the experience of their employees. The principle underlying those statements is that the state will neither underfund nor overfund health plan reserves. And then finally, we are looking to ensure that all health trusts manage their costs and control costs so that we avoid any Cadillac tax under the Affordable Care Act. And so that has provided the framework for the negotiations, and as we go forward, I'll talk a little bit about how that has played out in the bargaining. Turning to slide 8.
Could you pause just for a moment, Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On leave accrual, I don't need it now, but could you give us a number of total liability? We have an outstanding accrued leave. And the reason I'm asking that is, as we discuss the fiscal environment and as we look at reducing, if we reduce employment status in the state, there is a dollar amount that will cost on the leave buyout. I just want to be aware of what might be associated with those employees as we buy them out of their leave package. So what's our liability sitting in there?
I'll be glad to do that. Through the chair, I'll be glad to do that. We're in the process of calculating that right now. It has been trending down based on some of the terms we negotiated in prior contracts, but we'll work to get the final number for you.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Looking at slide 8, just kind of putting the state within some of the national and state trends, between 2007 and 15, on a national level, we saw a few pay increases and some furloughs in other states as they suffered through some of their financial challenges. The current trend outside of Alaska is to include increases, and states are beginning to eliminate furloughs. Within the state, you can see that some of the other political subdivisions have granted COLAs. This is a snapshot of one element of those bargained agreements, but you can kind of see that framework. Moving then to slide 9, and this really kind of defines our bargaining priority, and it's consistent with the discussion we've had to date on the cash compensation. Given that we're below market, we didn't make it a major point to try to extract substantial concessions on the cash component. It is our priority to maintain a 0-0-0 COLA environment, and then we also are seeking mandatory furloughs for all employees, and we'll talk a little bit about the value of those furloughs in a moment. On the benefits side, however, we are looking for more substantial reductions, particularly in the area of health care. We're asking employees to accept plan design changes, which will reduce health care costs as well as to contribute to the monthly premium. And then finally, the way this plays out in those funds that are or those trusts that are not managed by the state is we manage our contribution. And so in the discussions, we're looking to right-size the reserves that exist in those trusts. And so we're actually negotiating a rate that is below their cost level so that they will spend down reserves as a way of right-sizing the reserve. We're not asking, and it's not our position, that any reserve be unfunded to the level where they are unable to provide benefits to the employees. I think that's it's important that we continue to maintain those, but we want to right-size their reserves. Some other areas, other priorities in terms of objectives is to try to improve our performance evaluation system, to try to create consistency between our contracts. We came and gave a presentation on shared services where the idea was to be able to streamline and improve efficiencies, and consistency across the entire workforce is an important element to that, so that we can automate and standardize and we don't have to think about whether an employee is a member of one bargaining unit or another. And so whether it's leave or travel rules or pay procedures, we're just trying to standardize across all our bargaining units. We're looking for a little bit more flexibility, particularly in contracting out, as well as some promotional rules, so that we can ensure we've got the flexibility to manage appropriately. And then, there's obviously a cycle to these contracts, and so in some cases we're trying to reflect some of the leave terms that were negotiated in prior contracts into those contracts that are coming up. And so, let me pause for a moment. This is kind of the overall strategy that we've taken in our bargaining. Moving into slide 10, you can see how this played out, particularly in these two contracts. You have the monetary terms for these two contracts, and this is a summary of that. I'll spend most of my time, if it's okay, on the GGU contract, just because it's our largest contract. Nearly 8,800 employees. As you can see, we negotiated 0-0-0 really for both contracts. We reduced the health care contribution rate for 2017. In essence, what this means is that on an average basis over the 6 years, meaning the 3 years that have just passed, as well as the coming 3 years, the GGU bargaining unit will not receive any increase in health care contribution to the state from the state, even though health care costs have been growing 5 to 7% a year. And so I think that that will help them reduce their reserves. We're striving to get to where they've got something in the neighborhood of 5 to 7 months of reserves. That seems to be typical in the industry, and we think by the end of this three-year cycle that they'll be there or close there. They have agreed to 2 days of furloughs or 15 hours of furloughs, and then we also got some improvements in terms of grievance process, performance elements in terms of geographic limitations on layoffs, some consistency language on the contracts, as well as moving to the administrative manual for travel terms.
Senator McKinney.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to put on the record, we had a contentious closeout last year in trying to reach a consensus on the issue of labor contracts, and I just really want to commend the administration and those that bargained on behalf of this group of state employees. We value all of our state employees, and I know, Mr. Chairman, that you worked hard with a group of people to get us out of the third special session. And so I just want to go onto the record to say I appreciate the terms, the concessions for both parties, and the willingness to work together to try to do what was best for Alaska and this group of employees inside of this bargaining unit. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for and Senator Dunleavy for reaching out to a group of people to benefit, and I just I hope that the employees that are represented by this bargaining unit can appreciate the tough task that was in front of their negotiators in working with the state. And I just really, this is an example of compromise that I hope we all win by, and that families, working families, have people that can keep those families with incomes coming in instead of having to actually cut the position. So thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I echo those statements. I think that both of these bargaining units did come to the table recognizing their responsibility, and I appreciate the way they approached the negotiations. On slide 11, and I've only got a few more slides, you see those terms reflected in terms of dollar value. And what you see is that the contribution to health care represents about $4 million in terms of savings during fiscal year 17. The furlough, and I'm going to spend a minute, if it's okay, talking a little bit about that and breaking the number down. The total savings is about $4 million, although the cash savings will be about $1.4 million. And the reason for the difference is we would forecast that some subset of the employees, and it differs by kind of range, will cash in a portion of their leave in order to deal with those days, those furlough days. Now, that has value to the state. As Senator McKinnon noted earlier, we've got a large leave bank. It's, I don't have the exact number, but I know it's in excess of $250 million that is on our books of leave that has accrued. And so as they cash in, they're in essence decrementing against that leave bank. And we're estimating in our forecast that out of the nearly $3.3 million of lower wages that are paid, about 2.6 will actually get cashed in. And so there will be about 630 will actually result in savings. And but in addition to the leave for that the wages, the savings, forgive me, the savings associated with wages, there's another $760,000 of what we would call employer savings, which are the avoided contribution to the pension and to the leave rate. And so you combine those together and you end up with about $1.4 million of savings, cash savings for fiscal 17. As you can see, we did give a modest $29,000 to deal with some geodiff and subsistence outstanding issues, as well as about $36,000 for team for some special events coordinators. But net out of these two bargaining units, in fiscal year 17, there's about $5.3 million of savings associated with it. And so, again, this was a negotiated settlement, and I echo the words of and the sentiment of Senator McKinnon that I felt like these teams and their representatives negotiated in good faith and understood the situation the state is in.
Commissioner, where's that 5.3? On this
I'm
graph.
Sorry. If you look on the upper chart in the lower right-hand column, that five under the row that's labeled fiscal.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah.
It's in the blue. Got it. Thank you. Senator Machuca, you have a question?
Just a quick one. Commissioner, we don't have to do this online, but I'd like to understand how you value accrual, which that is the one outlier from the private sector. Most companies have reduced accrual fairly significantly. We're still up there. It's a significant exposure for the state. And when we talked about the full burden, and I hate using that word, it's just an industry term. It makes it sound like an employee does not receive fair value for their hard work. But I'd like to see how the department is sort of valuing accrual. It's when you on an per-employee basis, did you see any flexibility in reducing accrual rates during that? Because I noticed, I'm sorry I had to step out for that the end of that slide, but I noticed when you talked about the terms improvements regarding leave use and cash in, it'd be nice to understand that.
Through the chair, I would be happy to come back. What I'm trying to communicate with that statement is that in the last round of negotiation in the last few years, the state did negotiate changes to the accrual rate as well as caps on accrual. Now, I agree with your sentiment, which is that even with those reduced rates and those caps, we are above market, but we brought those down, and in this negotiating round, we're trying to bring those bargaining units that we've not yet negotiated in line with the other bargaining units that are out there. And so we did not attempt to make further reductions to get closer to market. We attempted to negotiate parity among the bargaining units, but we can provide some detail and come back to you with where that is and how we see that.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy? Oh, I thought you had a question. Excuse me. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Then moving to slide 12, this just is an update on the three other opening the three other bargaining units that were still in negotiation, labor, trades, and crafts. It's ongoing, and we think that we will be able to reach agreement by the 60th day. And the Confidential Employees Association, we also think we can reach agreement. The Supervisors Union, it's more challenging, and that's the one that I think there's a possibility we will not reach agreement by the 60th day, but I'm hopeful we'll reach agreement sometime during the session.
And Commissioner, could I get you to pause for just a second? Senator Dunleavy?
Commissioner, I'm sorry. It's actually the last item you'll go through, and so if you want to go through that, I can ask a question on the last item on this page.
What was the question?
I jumped the gun. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's the last item on the bottom of this page. I was going to ask a question on it.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
I was just going to mention, I think we've talked about that mostly, so I'm just
curious for the Chair. There was a tentative agreement. Legislature approved it, but it's not going to the members for vote?
So, yes. Through the Chair, NEBA has taken the position that while we reached tentative agreement and we thought we had an agreement, that we actually misunderstood the terms and that there was a misunderstanding. And so we are back at negotiation to see whether we can resolve that.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I misunderstood, too. So are we looking at 0, 0, and 0 like all the other contracts we're negotiating this year?
With
NEBA.
No, forgive me. If I said that, I...
No, you didn't say it. I'm saying it. There's new water. We have new water under us right now. And if we're in mediation, then we should be able to, under misunderstanding, I mean, I don't know if there's a specific point that we walked away from the table on and they thought that we agreed to something different. Is that what you're telling us?
Through the chair, our position in the negotiation has been that this deal, we negotiated in good faith and we are willing to live by it. And that's kind of been our position. Anything that deviates from this, we're basically saying then we would have to, if they want to deviate from the terms of this deal, then we've got to seriously look at what you're saying, which is that
right.
Everything's
we
on the table.
Reopen negotiations and it's all back on the table.
Yeah.
And then we would do something with our allocation that we approved already.
Through the chair, that's right. Although, as I mentioned before, we in essence haven't been paying them that 1% that would have been paid had they accepted that would have been paid this year.
Senator Dunleavy?
Just to be sure very quickly, on the NEBA issue, if you've TA'd off of everything, but then there's an item or two that there's a misunderstanding, Are those the only two items then that you discuss? In other words, if you already teed aid off on the increases, then that's not an issue of misunderstanding or contention. Basically, are those items accepted?
Through the chair, I suppose we could handle it that way, but in essence, what they're saying is that those areas that we had a misunderstanding, they would like us to increase to accept terms that will increase our cost. And that's where we're pushing back, and everything starts to blend together.
Senator Hoffman.
Clarify for me then, while we're talking about the Marine Engineers Benefit Association, they did not accept. So where does that fall in? Do you have to come to terms with them by the 60th day as well? And if there is one item that is changed, so the legislature gets a second bite of the apple on whether or not we want to approve or disapprove those terms.
Through the chair, if they accept the terms that we have negotiated, we do not have, it's my understanding that we would not bring that back to the legislature for approval, that you've approved that. If we change the monetary terms in any way, regardless of what the change is, then we would bring that back, and then you would have the same rights that you...
The complete package is for approval by the legislature.
All monetary terms, yes.
And then my second part of the question, does that time frame fall within the 60-day rule as well?
Yes. So, through the chair, if we were to reach agreement and come to you by the 60th day, then under para, the legislature would be obligated to take that up, and if it's beyond the 60th day, then it's at your discretion whether you take it.
And you talked about several contracts where, on page 12, the first two you anticipate coming before the legislature, and the Confidential Employees Association, not so. Do you anticipate that the Marine Engineers Benefit Association you're going to be able to reach those terms by the 60th day or not reach those terms by the 60th day? And the second is, can the legislature, since they did not agree, can the legislature withdraw its terms of agreement as well?
Through the chair, I'm reluctant to say this, but we don't seem to be making progress with MEBA, and so I have no reasonable belief that we'll come back to you by the 60th day unless something changes in our negotiations. In terms of the legislature's ability to withdraw your ratification or approval of that, it's my understanding, no, but I'm going to let Kate talk to that, or Ms. Sheehan.
Go ahead, Ms. Sheehan.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I actually do not know the answer to that. It was a legal question that we'll have to get an opinion on.
Go ahead, Commissioner. Senator Olson. Wait a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I guess if we do have a situation where they're going to strike, I'm assuming they have that right, and that what are the plans for the continuing on with the Marine Highway System?
Through the chair, at this stage, I think, first of all, both parties have filed an unfair labor practice mm-hmm. claim against the other, and during the pendency of a ULP, they are not entitled to strike. And so at this stage, they don't have that right. I think it would be better to have the Marine Highways talk about their contingency planning and strike planning criteria. I'm not up to speed on that. I'm hopeful that we can work our way through it. And at least at this stage, they've not been, to my knowledge, they've not been threatening strike in our negotiation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could clear my question up, I don't care what the union has to plan. That's their idea. That's what they want to do. You're with the administration, who's in charge of the DOT that runs the ferry system. What's the administration's plan on continue to provide service for people if they do strike after the ULP has either run out or the time frame has gone by?
Through the chair, I would like to invite the Marine Highway to answer that. I know that they're aware of this risk, but I don't know the particulars of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Plan.
Then I've just got two quick slides, and this reiterates, I think, the discussion we've had with respect to the rights of the legislature. Once we've reached tentative agreement, the monetary terms are brought to the legislature. You have the right to approve it or to reject it. As we've discussed, if it's before the 60 days, there's per the terms of PURA, the legislature is required to approve, to address it. After the 60 days, then it's up to the legislature whether they will choose to do so. If the union fails to ratify the agreement, as MEBA has, then the funding is reduced, and in essence, we operate under a status quo contract, the prior contract, and continue negotiations. And then my last slide, just going to slide 14, the terms that apply vary by contract in the event that the legislature rejects the monetary terms. And just focusing on the five contracts, you can see some, it signifies that impasse has been reached. And of course, when impasse has been reached, the bargaining unit can strike, the employer can implement. The five contracts that we're in negotiation with at this time, other than TEAM, which is the Teachers Education Association of Mount Edgecum, all of the others, in essence, they are either at impasse or can be at impasse within a short period of time. That being said, I think that in this climate, in this environment, we would expect to attempt to renegotiate and see if we can't come to an agreement to address any concerns. And that's the end of our presentation.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair. So if I heard correctly, there appears to be, at least in my mind, some clarification. When we looked at the graph, and you're going to get some details on that spread on the graph, you seem to indicate that, and you also mentioned in the former administration that there was increases in pay above and beyond to try, and there was a belief that we had to do that to retain folks, yet we're still having a hard time retaining folks. It comes down to pay, benefits, or working conditions, basically, is what you can negotiate and what the issues are. I don't know what you're prohibited by dealing by law and labor law, et cetera, but if we're going to enter into a period where it looks like future increases are very questionable because of our revenue situation, would you have discussions with folks over if the issue is working conditions, if there are things that we can do that are non-monetary to retain folks? Because it seems, we have a similar situation in rural Alaska with teachers. The pay is decent. The cost of living is definitely high. But there's other factors at play there. And I'm just wondering if those other factors at play, the working conditions concepts, are they going to get more scrutiny as we go through these processes where we may not have the money to pay folks?
Through the chair, I agree with you. That's why we've tried to take a constructive but balanced approach to these negotiations, where we are trying to address costs, address areas where we think we may be out of market, but I think we need to be fair to both sides, and I think these negotiations reflect that. But I do agree with you that to date, I think that we're kind of it's working. We've largely been able to attract people. It doesn't mean we don't have our challenges, but we've been able to. To use a market term, the market is kind of clearing. The bids and the ask, we're kind of being able to find people to do the work. And as this becomes more and more challenging, we'll have to continue to ensure that this is a place that people want to work. And part of that is working conditions.
Just one follow-up. And as you go through this process, I think it's hoped, and I don't know if you plan, but potentially getting back to this, where you might see some legislative remedies to some of these issues. In other words, you may be barred by some law that doesn't allow you to work maybe deeper, or however you want to word it, with bargaining units on working conditions. Maybe there's some other things that you see that we could change at the legislative level that can give you some tools that you need and to negotiate in a climate of falling revenue. Thanks.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for the backup documents that you provided that gave us a cross-section of the number of employees in each unit, the average age of those that are in the unit, so that we can look at retirement or how they're progressing through the salary scale, the average length of service, the average monthly pay for an employee, and the average overtime. And so, speaking specifically to the overtime issue, I'm wondering what the administration is doing at managing overtime. And I would just caveat this by saying I understand that the marine highway system is a valuable source of transportation for local communities. I used to live in Unalaska and was serviced by the ferry system. My family has lived on Kodiak many years ago. It was when I was very, very young. But I understand the value and the hard work of the people inside of the marine highway system and those units. But the overtime costs that the state is experiencing in that those specific units are huge. If I look at the State Employees Association, the GGU, the average employee is getting about $2,300 of overtime benefits. So we seem to be managing on land very effectively the use of overtime. But when I look at the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, their average in simple math is almost $7,800 per employee. And if I go to Marine Engineers, their average overtime is $9,800. And if I look at Masters, Mates, and Pilots, their average is almost $15,000 per employee for overtime. And so I know some of that's based on contract language and this home port issue that I raised earlier, that specific contract language that we may want to address in a next round of negotiations with folks. But what is the administration doing, in short, to manage overtime when we're trying to make sure that in this rough time that people can keep their jobs?
The Chair, specifically with respect to the marine highways, let us get some detail around that. As a general principle, overtime is managed at the department level, and prompted by your question, let us think about if there's information and detail that we can provide to these departments to help them understand where their overtime is at. To my knowledge, we haven't been, at this stage, haven't been done a lot of work around providing, from a central perspective, the overtime. I know in our department, we look at it and review it and make sure that we're managing it. But let us look at what we can do generally to think about that.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd appreciate that. We don't need to take more time on it today. My last question is the issue of treating all employees equally. That comes up sometimes. And when we're looking at the issue of furloughs, and there are people inside of the same work unit but not necessarily the same bargaining unit, I wonder how I very much appreciate negotiating furloughs into the contract and those bargaining units that have accepted that as a way to try to help maintain employment for those that are working inside of those units. But is there going to be an inequity in our staff, in our employee group, and how will we deal with that if some people are exempt from taking those furloughs? And that can be answered later or now.
Through the Chair, we're doing everything we can to ensure that there's not an inequity. I think it's critical. I accept the premise of your question. I think it's critical that everybody participate in that dimension.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to go back to overtime for a minute. Just for people that might be looking at these slides at home or around, you know, overtime, you got to look at it for what it is and look at it by bargaining unit. And I'll just do a little dive here into LTC, $10 million. Well, if you remember last year, we sat here until about 10 o'clock at night one night waiting for a bill to come from DOT to approve some funding for the Dalton Highway. And those employees of DOT had been fighting that Sag River for over a month trying to contain that, right? So there's overtime that's built into there. And I can tell you how, you know, go back and look at how many times Adigan Pass was closed to a snow event for 24 hours or longer, you know. So you got to look at, you know, there's a deeper dive when we're looking at the overtime, but so just don't think that they're out there driving up and down the road, and I'm not implying that, but just for people at home, you know, these guys are working around the clock and gals trying to get the road open that carries the mail on 90% of the revenue for the state budget.
Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 19, the non-coverage, I know we passed legislation on salaries for non-coverage, and I wonder if you can get me information as to details on are we hiring people at those levels or specifically those that are hired above and beyond for using the exemption rule, for my digestion to see where we are.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any other questions or comments? I guess we're done. We are adjourned.